From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, NASA released the first images from its new Mars orbiter called MAVEN with hopes of unlocking an ancient secret. What caused Mars' dramatic climate change from a planet with running water to the frigid, arid wasteland it looks like today? Of course, MAVEN is just one of many projects probing Mars lately. It joins a flotilla of other orbiters surrounding the planet and several rovers who've scooted over the Martian landscape, gathering samples and taking some incredible pictures. But for many astronomers, these robotic explorers only whet their appetites for the real deal, humans tromping on Mars' red dusty soil. And despite the huge obstacles that would have to be overcome to make that dream reality, some scientists believe a manned mission to Mars is not that far away. This group of optimists includes a Dutch company with a goal of colonizing Mars by 2025. Today in The Exchange, Mars Madness. We explore our fascination with this seemingly red, dead planet, what it would take to get there, and whether it would be worth the trip. What do you think? Should a mission to Mars be a goal or not? What hurdles do you see, technically or people-wise, that might get in the way? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us for the hour to explore this Mars topic are our Sky Guys, John Gianforte, equipment editor at Sky and Telescope magazine, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. His website is theskyguy.org. And John, it's great to see you, and a huge congratulations for your new job at Sky and Telescope magazine. That's fantastic.
Thanks very much, Laura.
Also with us, Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, good to see you, too. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, guys, before we get into, how we'd get to Mars, what we've learned so far, what more there is to learn, all the obstacles that might be in the way, including this project by the Dutch who are saying we're going to get there in 2025, which is not that far away. What do you think, Mal? Why are we so fascinated with Mars versus all the other planets?
Well, I think we've always been fascinated by Mars. You go back into history, and ever since they've seen Mars in the sky because it's red, that's how it got its name. It's named for the Roman god of war. If it were the Greek, it would be Ares. And they've always been wondering why it was so red. But also, as time went on, we've been looking at the other planets in our solar system, like the nearest ones, the other going the other way toward the sun, of course, is Venus, and realizing if we ever wanted to get off this planet, the only logical place to go that's somewhat nearby is going to be Mars. Actually, Mars has the same land mass over its whole planet because there is no water now there, although later we'll get into the idea that there evidently was water in the past.
Sure. Yes.
But right now, you take that total land mass of Mars, Mars being half the size of Earth, diameter-wise, and that land mass is the same land mass we have here on Earth.
So it's kind of a lot like us. That's why
we could all move there if we needed to. Yeah.
Well, a little bit later, we'll talk about all the people that are looking at that seriously, even though we're laughing now.
But consequently, you could not go to Venus, in other words, because of it's very dangerous. It is a carbon dioxide atmosphere there, but it's extremely hot and it's cloudy and very dangerous. But Mars is the more logical place to go because we want to get off the Earth at some point, I think, as humans. We went to the moon in the Apollo program, but now heading to Mars seems to be the next logical step.
The narrative now, John, that everybody talks about is that Mars did used to be wet, and we've talked on this program, the three of us, about those headlines as they've come out. How do we know for sure that Mars used to be wet? Are we still guessing or do we know?
We know. In the early 60s, when the first spacecraft, the Mariner missions, went to Mars and they took pictures of Mars from orbit as the spacecraft flew by, it revealed a bleak, dark, cratered planet, and the world lost interest in Mars. But as our optics, as our spacecraft got more sophisticated, as the pictures gave us better resolution and you could see more details, we started to see what looked like dried river valleys, runoff gullies, valleys, inviting places. And that kind of resurged the interest in Mars with the Mars Viking programs of the 70s, with the first rover, Sojourner, and Pathfinder missions, and then the Mars exploration rovers that were launched in 2004, or at least landed on Mars in 2004. Those rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, finally answered the question definitively that there was standing water on Mars for long periods of time in the distant past. So the question is today, and what drives a lot of Mars planetary exploration, is what happened on Mars to cause it to be a planet with an atmosphere thick enough to support liquid water, a planet that was warm enough to support liquid water in at least certain places, and why is it so different now? Because planetary evolution affects the Earth. So the Earth is going someplace in terms of its how it's changing as a function of time. So we want to get a handle on what causes planets to change over time.
How did the rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, definitively tell us, yes, indeed, there was water?
The Mars, there was a lot of space. There are many spacecraft. Mars Odyssey, Mars Global Surveyor, orbited Mars before the rovers got there, and picked out areas that they thought had mineral deposits that, at least on Earth, would have formed in the presence of water. They then directed the Mars rovers and other future spacecraft to land in those places. And when Mars Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars in January of 2004, a short time after they arrived there, they began to confirm the presence of materials, hematite for one, which forms in the presence of water, were discovered in many places in the landing sites. So they had definitive chemical evidence that water, dissolved salts were found that could have only been deposited in the presence of water.
So it's not just that we're looking at formations and going, gee, that looks like a dried riverbed, but really, who knows? There's chemical evidence now.
Yes.
From these rovers. What's the implication of that, Mal? That opens up a whole world of possibilities, doesn't it, about Mars?
Well, it does. And one of the things that's interesting is that, of course, if there's water present at any time, in our dealings with water on the Earth, we need water to have life. And so the next logical step is, well, if there was water there, then there must be some life, maybe fossils or something that might be embedded there. There's also the possibility that there could be life underneath the surface, because the surface itself is rather sterile at this point because of the lack of atmosphere. So we're probing eventually for life. Now, for years, I think this is part of the, in recent history especially, the idea of Mars is dealing with the possibility and the thought that has mostly been fiction up until now anyway, that there are beings, Martians, living there, and that's another fascination with the planet.
Although they might not be little green men. They might be microbes or whatever.
Well, a lot of it goes back to the late 1800s. In 1877, a guy named Giovanni Schiaparelli, an Italian astronomer, was looking at Mars more clearly through a larger telescope at the time, and drew what he saw as lines across the face of the planet that he called canali, which in Italian means basically channels.
Or canals, yeah.
Or canals is the way we did it. And now, whether they were natural or not, people wanted to believe eventually that these were actually built by intelligent beings, because they knew it was a dry planet. And so they were taking water from the ice caps and rerouting them to the rest of the planet, that sort of thing. That created a great folklore about life on Mars. And in 1898, that's when H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds, based upon that type of ideas of canals, and that there were beings on Mars who wanted to come to Earth because we had more water, that sort of thing.
Well, and I love that history and lore that you bring to the table, Mal, because now we actually have confirmation that maybe there weren't little green men building canals, but
exactly,
there was water there. So it all fits together. Yeah,
exactly.
Go ahead, John.
The interesting thing about that was when Schiaparelli used the word canali, in translated into from Italian into English. In Italian, canale means channel. But when the American media heard the word canale, they instantly made the association with canal, which implies of intelligent origin.
Right. A channel is something nature could create. A canal is something man creates.
Right. So that immediately took us off in a new direction in terms of science fiction that said, oh, my goodness, there's intelligent people, beings, building canals to take, like Mal said, to take the water from the poles, where we knew there was water at the poles, to the dry, warmer equatorial regions. So that's what started all of this science fiction and this lore from the mid-1800s.
All right. Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're spending the hour looking at Mars, what we know so far about the red planet, and some very serious planning underway to send people there. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. What hurdles do you see, either in terms of the personnel involved or the technical problems that would be put in front of a mission to Mars? Do you even think a mission to Mars should be a goal for this country or not? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email that just came in from Steve in Nottingham. He says, why is Mars called the red planet? And by the way, he talks about the relationship between candy bars and stars, Mars bars, Milky Way candy bars. Thank you, Steve, for that. But Mal Cameron, why is Mars called the red planet?
Well, because that's the way it looks in the sky. It isn't red. You look at it up close, though. It's more brownish or pinkish.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. I don't have a definitive answer for it because when I look at it, though, if you look at it when it's low on the horizon, it may appear a little bit redder. But I think people perceive that it is more toward the red side. And they've seen red stars, too. And that can be a comparison of sorts as you look at the night sky. But it just has been a traditional thing to call it the red planet, I guess.
Well, Steve, good question. We'll take more of your questions in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. Email us like Steve did, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're spending the hour taking a close look at Mars, why scientists are so fascinated by it, and how serious planning is underway right now to get people there. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Mal Cameron is here, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. Also, John Gianforte, equipment editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. John's also involved, by the way, in planning the New England Fall Astronomy Festival this weekend at UNH Durham. More information on that on our website, nhpr.org. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, we've talked about what we've learned so far from all the orbiters and rovers that have been, you know, orbiting around Mars or scooting around on the planet. Anything else, John Gianforte, that we have learned just in the last few years, given all the technology that's been floating around Mars or on the surface of Mars?
Well, a good way to get to know a planet for future human missions there is to spend time there studying the planet from orbit and also on the surface. And that's what's been done by the European Space Agency, now India's Space Agency, as well as, of course, NASA. So we've gained a tremendous amount of general information about the thickness of the atmosphere, the profile of the atmosphere, how it gets thicker toward the planet. Of course, the lower in elevation, the thicker the air is. We know a lot about the content of the rocks on Mars, what the atmosphere is composed of, all very important. Mars has an atmosphere, and therefore it has weather. So there are weather systems. There are clouds on Mars. When the Phoenix lander landed in a northern Arctic region of Mars, it actually landed on a skating rink. It landed on pure ice buried only a few centimeters beneath the surface.
Water ice?
Water ice.
Wow.
As flat as you can imagine. Right beneath the spacecraft. It's absolutely stunning. They went there looking for ice and they found it. So we've learned that there's lots and lots and lots of water on Mars, but it's all frozen. It's not liquid. The atmosphere is too thin to support liquid water. Even if it were 70 degrees Fahrenheit, there's not enough air on Mars pushing down to keep water in the liquid state. If you walked to your mailbox on Mars from your house to get the newspaper and you had a cup of water, by the time you got to the mailbox, the water wouldn't be frozen. It would have evaporated.
Really?
Because the atmosphere is not thick enough on Mars. We know that definitively now. We know exactly what the atmospheric profile is on Mars. Just recently, with the MAVEN mission that you mentioned in your intro, we are beginning to understand exactly why Mars lost its atmosphere. Right now,
that's the big question, isn't it, John?
Yes. And when MAVEN looks at Mars, it sees lots of atomic hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon, which is the result of sunlight breaking down carbon dioxide into its constituent chemical elements. So those things are like in a fog around Mars that have escaped the gravity of Mars, but still can influence its weather. But it has left Mars with a very thin atmosphere, about 100 times thinner than the atmosphere of the Earth.
Oh, we forget how protective, not forget, but don't sometimes fully appreciate how protective Earth's atmosphere is, John.
That's absolutely right.
Mal, go ahead, and then we'll take a call.
Yeah, we also know that in its past, apparently Mars had a liquid center, kind of like the Earth, that was spinning at such of liquid iron that was creating a magnetic field around Mars that has dissipated too, probably because of the size of Mars being smaller. That process slowed down, and it took away a lot of that that magnetic field, which caused more radiation to come into the planet and wear away the atmosphere around it. And that was millions of years ago. But it's very important to understand that process, because we can also see how that may affect the Earth down the road a few million years from now, too.
Wow.
If our core were to do the same thing. It's unlikely, because our planet is bigger. And if it does degrade at all, it would be a much slower process. But by studying Mars, we're also learning a little bit more about the Earth in the process.
Let's take a call, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions about Mars this hour in the exchange. What we know so far from all the orbiters and probes, and what it might take to get people on the red planet. There's a lot of planning underway toward that goal. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Eric's in Conway. Hi, Eric. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm concerned with the hurdles of getting people to Mars, or actually any space travel, and I want to know what's being done in these fields. First, we have to get out of the gravity well without putting people on top of what amounts to a giant Roman candle. And then once we get out of the gravity well, we have to travel at a speed that will get us there in a reasonable amount of time. And so it seems to me propulsion is key to any kind of space travel. And what kind of research is being put into that?
Well, Eric, it's a great question. And before we talk about, you know, what people might see on Mars, how they would survive, whether they die in 68 days like those MIT students said they would, he's absolutely right, John Gene Forty. It's a lot to get there.
It's a big problem. It takes a long time to get there unless you want to build a rocket with a big gas tank, which is expensive and dangerous. So you use gravity assist to get there, but it takes 8 to 9 months to get there. Now, we could get there quicker, but it's more expensive. So propulsion is certainly a big impediment to quick and much easier, simpler space travel. There is research being done on different kinds of engines. Right now, the Dawn mission from NASA that has explored Vesta, one of the biggest asteroids in the inner asteroid belt, and is on its way to Ceres, located in the outer asteroid belt, does not use a conventional chemical rocket. It uses an ion thruster, which is very efficient, very slow, but very efficient, and doesn't carry the chemicals. So there are there is lots of research work being done on propulsion systems, but to put them into mainstream spaceflight in the next 5 years is probably not going to happen. But Eric is exactly right. It is very risky getting people out into space and escaping the gravity well of the Earth, as you say. But in terms of living in space, that's one of the goals of the International Space Station, is to help prepare us biologically for what we can expect for long-duration space flights.
Well, and from what I've read about long-duration space flights, John Mell, I'll ask you this. Radiation is a big concern.
Absolutely, yes. And because of the lack of if you're going to Mars especially, even staying on Mars can be dangerous because of that lack of magnetic field, because it lets the radiation from the sun go directly to the surface as well. So it's not just getting out of the gravity well, as Eric says, and the time frame. And by the way, just as an aside for the time frame, John mentioned the International Space Station. Being close to Earth, it's a great way to, as a laboratory, test that amount of time in space, in actually microgravity in that case, but with the lack of floating around and no gravity to speak of. They stay on the crew people stay there for about 6 months at a whack right now.
Sure, and Mars will be more like 8 or 9,
right.
So close.
And then starting next year, there's going to be two people who are going to spend a full year on the space station and be studied to see how they can do it. The problem is bone mass degradation, muscle mass. You have to exercise faithfully for hours at a time sometimes.
Just to keep your muscle mass.
But then, yes, normal. You do have to protect them from radiation on the way, because you have to be inside a radiation shield to travel there. But think about traveling on a small spacecraft with a crew of 5 or maybe 7 people or something. There are spacecraft that are being developed right now. NASA's working on one called Orion, which will hold 4 people. They want to use that as a multi-purpose spacecraft to visit, first of all, an asteroid, because that would be closer. You don't have to go to the asteroid belt, which is the main belt beyond Mars, but there are some asteroids closer to us. They want to try that first, and then eventually use a similar capsule to go to Mars. Now, that's a cramped quarters. Imagine a camping trip with your family and a few other relatives maybe joining you, but the weather
probably
is
a bad example.
The weather is so bad, you cannot leave your camper. You cannot go outside and get away from everybody.
You can't stop at a rest stop.
So you have to have – and when you go, you have to think about all the things you're going to bring with you that you just cannot go back and get spare parts, for example. You can't go back and do things. And so they're trying to learn how to grow things in space, to make your own meals and things. There's a lot involved in thinking about going to Mars. You just can't say blatantly, I'm going to go to Mars today.
Well, that's a thing.
And it does take months to get there.
And when you talk about, you know, just little things like, you know, the radiation. I mean, it's not a little thing, but radiation, food, waste products, whether you can get along with these people for 9 months in close quarters. I mean, you look at some of the Apollo capsules, and they're tiny, but they were only stuck together for 3 days, not 9 months. So it almost just seems impossible, Mal. It just seems like throw your hands up and say, you know, it's too difficult.
You have to do a lot of training and a lot of living together with people on Earth to see how they relate to each other and whether they can actually maybe not be the worst family situation where they might be snickering at each other all the time. Or you don't want them when you go to Mars, you've got to spend months to get there. And then you've got to, if you do land, you've got to spend probably at least another 6 months on the planet before you can even think about coming back home. So a decent mission to Mars and back is going to be probably about 2 years anyway. So you better really know the people you're going to send and how they can get along with each other, or if you want them all to come back alive.
Yeah, and I have another question for you on that. Here's an email, though, from Don, who says, a Mars trip is not possible because of near-fatal cosmic and solar radiation dose unless the crew vehicle is heavily shielded. Don says, putting this in common terms, astrobiologists said one half of the crew will need a bone marrow transplant upon arrival at Mars. And presumably, Don doesn't say this, there are no hospitals there to do the bone marrow transplant. But this raises another question that we've talked about before, guys. And John, I'll ask you, when scientists speculate about who might be best to make this mission, they came out a while back and said the best astronauts would be a 50-something married couple because they're not going to have kids, right? They're 50, so they're done, so the radiation wouldn't affect future offspring. And also, you know, if they've been married a long time, they know that they can sort of stand each other in close quarters for a long time.
Well, my reply to that is, let me think about that a minute.
Now, to your wife.
I'd love to go to Mars with my wife, but I'd want other people to go along. And certainly the logic behind that is, of course, you don't have to worry about your reproductive systems, right? Because, yes.
It's a big concern.
Right. I mean, there is an issue with biology, errors in DNA that suffer from radiation. We don't realize how important Earth's magnetic field is for us to protect us from charged particles. So not only is there radiation like UV, X-rays, and gamma rays that flood the solar system, the Earth included, that our atmosphere protects us from, but there are charged particles coming from the sun. And whenever the sun undergoes a coronal mass ejection or a solar flare, kind of like a kid throwing a temper tantrum, those charged particles emanate from the sun at high speed that are very, very dangerous to crews who don't live in a magnetosphere. And that's you in a spaceship to Mars. So certainly shielding of that spacecraft is going to be very important, and people going to and from Mars are going to be at risk.
Okay, well, Don, thank you for the email. And let's take another call. This is Dan in Farmington. Hi, Dan. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to play a little bit of devil's advocate for a moment. I love the discussion so far, and none of the technical obstacles really bother me all that much. There are answers to each of these problems, and most of these technologies are already in place. They are, on the other hand, massively expensive. And the funding for a manned trip to Mars, I mean, the cost is appropriately astronomical.
And no pun intended, right, Dan?
Well, precisely. And so I'm beginning to wonder, where is this money going to come from? And if the answer is government, why should we as taxpayers in a country with trillions of dollars worth of debt even begin to care about paying for a trip to Mars?
Well, Dan, I really appreciate the call. I want to let you know that before the show, Bernadette sent us a Facebook comment kind of saying the same thing you say, Dan. She says, a mission to Mars, huh? When we have hundreds of thousands of people on Earth starving and dying every day for lack of a better quality of life. Bernadette says, let's get our priorities reoriented. What a waste of money that could be better used for better health care, jobs, infrastructure, schools, and a whole host of needs. So, Dan, others are asking the same questions that you're asking. Why should government fund this? There's a lot of private funding getting involved now, too, which maybe I'll ask you guys about. But go ahead on the government funding, John Gene 40.
It's a very good point. Keep in mind that scientists, biologists, anyone that has any interest in going to Mars are also taxpayers. They have relatives and friends, maybe themselves, affected by disease or knows someone who's low income that needs help. Certainly, we have a lot of priorities on Earth. We have had them since civilization began. We have had very smart human beings try to conquer those problems and will continue to do so long into the future. I agree that we need to prioritize our efforts in science. But science has brought us some of the same medical cures and some of the same miniaturized electronic equipment that is used in hospitals, that we use to communicate with each other every day, that are offshoots of the space R&D program that was started in the 1950s. You are benefiting from that right now. Every time you use a microwave oven, every time you use high-quality precision bearings, low-cost, low-weight materials that are used in airplanes that you probably have traveled in. All of that R&D was spurred by money spent developing technologies for space that leaked into the economy, not in the first 3 or 4 years, but it took 5, 10, 15, or 20 years to find their way into products that have made our lives easier.
So, John, you're making the point that research spent trying to figure out how to get people to Mars might have spin-offs that we can't even imagine right now.
It will absolutely have those kind of spin-offs in the future.
The other broader point that I think John touched on earlier, Mal, I'll ask you too, this question of, you know, what happened to Mars? How did it go from being presumably a wet planet to being the dry, you know, not so hospitable place that we see today? That's another big question that people want answered for our own future.
Right. It's not going to affect us here on the Earth as far as comparing it to Earth and that sort of thing. But Mars has had an interesting history. And what happens is that when we send robotic missions to Mars, the research that's done through those robots is extremely slow and time-consuming. You can only do one little thing at a time. Everything's controlled from the Earth. It's not like having a person on there, because that's really the reason for going in the first place, is to get more a quicker assessment of what's going on with Mars. A human being walking around on Mars can do a lot faster science, know what they're looking for, pick things up more quickly that a robot can miss, only because whoever's driving the robot doesn't see it through their camera necessarily. It's a very slow thing. When you send a signal to Mars for a robot to say, gee, there's an interesting rock I see through your camera up here, let's drive toward that rock. You send it the signal to drive there, and that signal is going to take 8 or 10 minutes or more just to get to it to see it move, and it's very slow and tedious.
And if there's a more interesting rock next to that rock, the robot doesn't know because
exactly,
it hasn't been programmed.
But a human can see that and recognize it.
All right. Well, Dan, really appreciate the point. Thank you for being with us. More on Mars in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a special edition of our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today, will we ever get to Mars? And should that even be a goal? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Mal Cameron, John Gianforte, as we've been diving into this issue of what it would take to send people to Mars, whether it would be worth the money, whether we should spend our money on other things, here's a Facebook comment from Bill that came in earlier. He says, when we put on Facebook, how long do you think it would take before humans make it to Mars? Would you want to go? That was the question we posed. Bill says, 15 years tops if SpaceX doesn't get stopped. Never if NASA is doing it. This is the point that more and more we're seeing in some of these space missions, is that private funding is filling in the gap. It also gets to Dan's question earlier about why should the government spend money. Talk a little bit more, Mal, if you could please, about the rising role that private explorers are playing in this.
Well, there are a few. SpaceX is a good example. Elon Musk, who runs it, who I guess he founded PayPal and was it Tesla, the car. He's into a lot of fun technology things.
And most of them quite successful.
But yeah, SpaceX has done a remarkable job over the past few years. They landed just recently a huge contract with NASA to help develop privately launch systems to get heavier things into orbit. They also have working on a space capsule to bring people into space. NASA has their Orion capsule they've been working on to hold four people. SpaceX has kind of a capsule that looks pretty much the same. It looks like the Apollo capsule, the command module capsule. But he's got one that will hold seven people in a two-tiered arrangement inside. And he would like to get a private thing going into space at least, and maybe eventually on to Mars. As far as to an earlier question that we had about the cost of going to Mars, it isn't something, it's that big an expense that it would not be something, in my feeling, that U.S. would do by itself. We would need international help with it. It would have to be a global effort to work together to come up with the funding to send a mission to Mars. And that would kind of soften the blow a little bit.
But I think that
getting
is,
to that funding
is exactly
issue
right.
That people keep
I think that is so important. It shouldn't be. I agree with the person who responded to the question online. It should not be solely a U.S. effort and a cost having to be paid by U.S. taxpayers. That wouldn't be right. It's not our planet. It's not our solar system. We're part of a global community of human beings. We should explore it together, share the cost with private and government participation. And together, it's much less expensive, and it becomes a much less impossible and doable task if we cooperate, which leads to a lot of other positive effects on this planet.
Exactly.
Well, and so speaking of this, let's talk about the Mars One project. This is a Dutch nonprofit that says it wants to get a colony on Mars by 2025. Now, we'll obviously talk about some of the issues that have come up, but in terms of the funding, okay, this group says, hey, we could get broadcast deals similar to what partially fund the Olympics and the international soccer competitions, the FIFA competitions. Once the colonists launch and land, the world's eyeballs will be on this mission. So that's a great advertising opportunity. That's a possible new way of looking at revenue. We don't have to just say, NASA do this, NASA don't do this. Another stream of revenue, according to these folks, are potential suppliers, Lockheed Martin and other sort of big, you know, aerospace and aircraft companies. So people start to think outside the box, John, in terms of, you know, the old funding models.
Well, let me kind of prop up NASA for a minute. If you look at the missions that NASA has conducted, many of those missions were launched in the 70s, are still sending data back to Earth. That is an amazing accomplishment. Space is a difficult place to operate. But NASA can't do it alone. As good as they are a government agency, and a lot of the private agencies, Virgin Galactic, and as we also talked about, SpaceX, companies like that are going to make space more affordable and more traveled by more people, which will actually help reduce the cost.
All right. Now, I want to ask both of you about this Dutch Mars One project in just a moment, but let's go back to our listeners. And Dan is waiting in Dover. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Fine.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. My question is one, basically, feel out how your guests, what they think about whether or not we have the right to go to Mars. On the one hand, we have Carl Sagan's quote that civilizations become spacefaring or extinct. But I guess the other side of the coin is, you know, do we really have the right to go there where there may be some sort of biology developing that we're not quite aware of yet?
You know, that's a really great point. And if there were some microbial life or even larger life on Mars and astronauts went there, we might end up killing it, you know, unintentionally. Do you want to jump on that first, John, and Mal?
I mean, that's a very good question, and it certainly is a question that spacefaring nations have thought about. All spacecraft that go whose destination is a planetary body now must be sterilized. The missions to Mars were sterilized to be as sure as we could be.
They wouldn't kill anything. Yeah. So the rovers were sterilized.
Right. So, I mean, those efforts, no doubt, are not perfect. And should we discover in the next 2 to 5 or 10 years microbes living on Mars, that becomes even more important because maybe, as Sagan also said, Mars would then belong to the Martians. So it makes us think about those ethical questions, right? Who are we to come in there and terraform Mars, make it more Earth-like if someone else is already living there? And if those someone else's are little green microbes instead of little green men and women, well, that needs serious consideration and even more effort to make sure that we don't pollute Mars. It's a very big ethical question, which will be examined in close detail going forward.
Well, Dan, it's a great question. Thank you for raising it. So speaking of terraforming Mars,
add to that just a little bit. Back in the Viking days, in the 1970s, mid-1970s, we landed the Viking landers on Mars, two of them, and they had a robotic arm that would dig out the soil, bring it back to a little laboratory on board to look for the signs of life.
Even in the 70s, landing on Mars. Wow.
Yes. And that was something that when they did the chemical analysis, they thought they detected some chemical ideas of the existence of possibly some microbial life. But it wasn't sure because they also admitted that once you're there, when no matter what you do for your sterilization of the spacecraft, you apparently, at least at that time, could not get rid of every single microbe that may be hitching a ride from Earth to Mars.
Oh, dear. So they weren't really
and
sure.
So they weren't sure that would be something that was brought to Mars by us that got into the mix, or whether it actually was something on Mars. So it was very inconclusive.
Wow. Did they ever figure that out for sure, Mal?
Well, not really.
The chemical, that's a huge story that's still making the news today, right, is the analysis of the Viking chemical analysis. The Viking missions 1 and 2 that landed on Mars in 76 were really the only missions from NASA whose goal it was to look for life. All the other missions that have gone to Mars looking to determine if Mars was or is habitable. Could life have or could it exist on Mars now? Okay. Not actually looking for little bugs. If a bug crawled up one of the rover's wheels and legs, it may not know about it because it wasn't designed to see life. The Vikings were designed to test for life. Unfortunately, we didn't know as much about Mars in the 70s as we do now. We now know that Mars has no ozone. No protective layer that shields it from the Earth, from the sun's ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation destroys complex carbon molecules. No ozone, that means even though Mars is further from the sun than the Earth, there's lots of UV light that strikes the surface of Mars. No ozone, no protection. So
no protection for life, at least as we know it. There could be other forms of life that are perfectly fine without it.
Right. But as much as we know about biology, as much as we know about the one example of life in the universe, it has to be associated with carbon so far as we know. And there's a lot of good reasons for that we can't go into right now. But UV radiation from the sun will destroy life, like carbon, complex carbon molecules that are essential for life as we understand it.
Life as we understand it.
So it's not surprising that we got unexpected results on Mars, because there isn't going to be any organic sitting out in a desert on Mars, because they're going to have been fried long ago by the UV radiation reaching the surface of Mars.
Wow. Okay. Well, again,
you could bring a plant to Mars and put it in the ground on Mars, and it wouldn't survive because of all that radiation. It would not grow. It wouldn't be enough nutrients. There's not enough air for it to work with. There's a lot of carbon dioxide that it could use, because you think, okay, plants breathe carbon dioxide and they give out oxygen. But that wouldn't work on Mars because it's too sterile for it to happen. The other thing with the dangerous types of bacteria or whatever that we could pick up on Mars, that applies to people too. Imagine going to Mars and then coming back to Earth. You're pretty sure you're going to be in isolation for a long time before you're allowed to go out and be among the public and be the hero that went to Mars, because they want to make sure not only did you survive Mars, but did you bring something back from Mars we don't know about, too?
Well, that gets to this Dutch group, Mars One, Dutch nonprofit. It's got some interesting, innovative funding ideas that I talked about a moment ago. But they want to start a colony there, Mal, by 2025. By my detailed calculation, that's 11 years away.
Right.
Not that far away. I mean, is this ridiculous, crazy? Do they have a point? What do you think?
It certainly is ambitious, but what are they going to do for housing? What are they going to build, an inflatable housing thing with them? Or I haven't read the proposal on it, but it's a very challenging just to get to Mars. I kind of prefer the way that NASA's doing it. Slowly, methodically getting as much information about what to expect when you get to Mars and where is a good place to land to get the most science from Mars and to be able to land on Mars more accurately as well to get you to that specific spot on Mars.
Well, as you talked about plants drying up and so forth and just all the difficulties, MIT students, John G. and Forty, did a feasibility study of this Dutch project, Mars One, colonization by 2025. Not a big colony, you know, but still. And this MIT analysis, anyway, said partly for the reasons that Mal talked about, these folks would die within 68 days.
Well, these are students. And they're
the
going,
MIT
they're,
people.
They're,
seven,
they're scientists, and they are trained to be skeptical. And there's good reason to be skeptical. First of all, Mars One mission is a one-way mission to Mars. These people are not they're not intending to come back
home.
Yeah,
they're colonizing.
Right? They're going to be there, and they're going to send four at first. And then every 2 years, when Mars and Earth reach a minimum distance, they're going to send two more. So they will slowly build over time. But the MIT study brought up points when they did – they modeled the requirements of a living community on Mars. It turns out in order to grow their own food
– which you'd have to do over that long period of time.
That's right. Because
you can't bring
enough.
You can't
take it with you. They would need a surface area four times the size of what the Mars One plan calls for. And the Mars One plan calls for the people living with the crops. The crops produce too much oxygen, and that would be a tremendous fire hazard to the people who live there. So, you know, it's not something that you can accomplish and overcome all of the obstacles in 11 years. So, but I applaud them for being bold, for putting this out there. People are going to comment. They're going to debate. They're going to argue. They're going to have fights. They're going to have journal articles published about that. And what does that do? That brings us closer to what we really need to do to get there successfully.
So we start thinking, how do we deal with the oxygen issue? How do we deal with the food issue? How do we deal with the air issue? And so
the report that these students wrote is doing exactly what scientists do. They debate, they collaborate, they confront each other with their opinions on what they know, what their fields of expertise are, and we eventually converge on the right way to go there.
Well, there's a great article in The Universe Today. That's a website that I often go to for information for these astronomy shows. And just yesterday, someone wrote an article about this whole Mars One project and then the MIT students and then the Mars One folks rebutting. And so it's exactly what you say, John. People putting out their ideas, other people saying no, no. And then the people coming back and saying, but wait, 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 you don't understand me. And it's a great debate happening. Speaking of scientists getting together this weekend at UNH Durham, the New England Fall Astronomy Festival. What's on tap, John?
Well, we have a great program again planned for this year. It's our fourth year holding NEFAF, as it is affectionately known as. Tomorrow night, Dr. Carolyn Porco, the science imaging team leader for the NASA Cassini mission to Saturn, which was launched in 1997, arrived at Saturn in 2004, and has been studying Saturn, its rings, its atmosphere, and its moons since 2004. And it is still operating today. So Dr. Porco will talk about a decade studying Saturn. Chances are, if you have ever seen or handled a picture of Saturn or any of the outer planets, Dr. Porco has had her hand in creating that image. So she'll be giving our keynote address at 7 o'clock at the UNH Observatory. I think we have a link to it on the NHPR website. All day Saturday, this is a free event to the public, all day Saturday. We have a host of events for people interested in science from all ages. We have Observing the Night Sky on Friday and Saturday nights, and a host of events for kids and for adults all day on Saturday.
NHPR.org to find out more. John Gianforte, it was great to see you. Have fun this weekend.
I will. Thank you, Laura.
John Gianforte, equipment editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. Mal Cameron, it was wonderful to see you, too. Thank you very much.
Great to be here again. Thanks.
Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. We're going to close out our show today with a piece by Gustav Holst called Mars, the Bringer of War.